Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, you may not have heard the term before, but I'm going to chat with someone about mental health first aid and an event coming up in the area that will allow those who are trained in it to meet and collaborate. Jay Fox will talk to an expert about tech options for senior citizens in Columbus. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, the Mental Health First Aid Collaborative is an organization that is out there doing some great work. They offer courses to equip people to recognize the signs of a mental health or substance abuse issue and helps give the tools and confidence to take action and step in and help. Coming up in Columbus, they'll be having a big event out at the Columbus Zoo, and we're going to get to that. But first, we're going to learn more about the Mental Health First Aid Collaborative with a director from the organization, Janet Gora. Janet, thanks so much for joining us today on Columbus Perspective.
You're very welcome, Kay. Thank you for inviting me.
So tell me about the Mental Health First Aid Collaborative. I understand it's pretty active here in the state of Ohio.
It sure is. So I didn't know anything about mental health first aid before I started 4 years ago. So they hired me to run a project that we got a grant funding from the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, or OMHAS, as we call them, back in 2020, right when the pandemic started. And so they hired me and they said, we got a grant and we want to reach as many people in Ohio with this training class. Mental Health First Aid is from the National Council for Mental Wellbeing. It actually came from Australia, and it is a worldwide evidence-based class that helps lay people recognize the signs and symptoms of mental health or substance use disorders, and then know how to approach the person, know what to say, know what not to say, and then get them help. So we give them a bunch of resources, and you can tailor your resources as a referral as a mental health first aider to the person that you're working with. So we don't diagnose, we're not counselors, we're lay people, but it's kind of like first aid that you get somebody help if they're having a heart attack or a stroke, you get them to the professional so that they can get help. And you're much, much more likely to see somebody with a mental health or substance abuse issue than you are with a heart attack or stroke. In fact, one out of every five people have a mental health issue. So that's a lot of people. And so what we're trying to do is get this training in the hands of lay people so they can really make a difference in their own lives, their loved ones' lives, their colleagues, you know, even future generations. So we're really excited about this program.
The term mental health first aid, I have to be honest, I don't think I'd ever heard it put that way before, but your explanation makes so much sense. Like you said, someone having a heart attack or a stroke, all of us have at some point in time been exposed to some sort of information that says, here's how to help them. But none of us have really ever been told, here are steps you can take if you find someone that you think is suffering from a mental health disorder or from a substance use disorder. And I think language is so important here. So tell me, Janet, when you are offering the education and the courses that you do through the Mental Health First Aid Collaborative, who are you targeting for these services, for these educational opportunities?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we have different types of funding, and the funders actually tell us who they want us to reach out to. So OMHAS has told us a list of at-risk communities where suicide rates are high, depression is high, anxiety is high, and they say, here's who we want you to reach. So that list includes minorities, LGBTQ plus community, rural communities, veterans, first responders, military, older adults, youth, so anybody 8 to 18, college age youth is on that list. We work with certified peer recovery supporters in Ohio. We train them. I'm sure I'm probably forgetting one or two audiences, but that's basically who they tell us. And so the other grant we have is through SAMHSA, and that's a federal grant, and that's in Northern Kentucky. And we have same group, but it's college students and helping professions, first responders, people in high risk industries like construction workers. So it really depends on the funder. They tell us who they want us us to reach, and then we do outreach for those audiences and find host organizations that want to host the class.
Interesting. So really, anyone listening right now could go to your website and explore the services you offer to educate someone to become a mental health first aid responder, so to speak.
Exactly. And we do have classes that we provide to businesses, and they pay us to do this class because it's so valuable. So anybody that doesn't qualify for one of our grants can still get mental health first aid training. They would just have to sign a contract with us, and we would send our instructors and do everything else exactly the same and go out to the business. So we probably average 2 classes a month that people pay us to do this that don't qualify for these grants because the class is so impactful.
Janet Gora is a director for the Mental Health First Aid Collaborative for Mental Health America. They provide education to, as she's put it, lay people, people in the community who want to be more well-versed in how to approach someone who may be dealing with a mental health or substance use disorder issue. And it's such a valuable type of information to have. I'm so curious, what got this all started?
That is a great question. And it's a great story. So there was a nurse in Australia, and she suffered from depression and numerous suicidal attempts. And she was teaching first aid class. And her husband, who is a mental health researcher, they were on a walk with their dog one morning, supposedly, and they said, why don't we have a curriculum that teaches people how to help people with mental health issues? And so between those two, they developed this curriculum, and it spread across Australia, and it spread in, I think it's in 26 different countries now internationally. And it came to the United States in about the year 2000 with the adult curriculum. Since then, they've added a youth curriculum, which is people that work with specifically 8 to 18-year-olds. And then in 2018, they also added a teen mental health first aid curriculum, which are you're directly teaching teens in 9th, 10th, 11th, or 12th grades, the whole grade, about how to help themselves and how to help their peers. So it really continues to expand across the years, but it came from that one idea from that one nurse in Australia.
Wow, that's really amazing, especially considering she herself was kind of in the midst of needing someone to administer mental health first aid to her, it sounds like.
Yes, and we talked to a lot of people, and they said, if I only had somebody in my life, especially when I was growing up, that recognized the signs and symptoms and could get me help earlier, I wouldn't have to struggle, because there's 11 years of wait between when the onset of symptoms occur and when people go to seek treatment. And that's way, way, way too long. So the more people that know this, the more people we can get help with the first year or so. And then their symptoms don't worsen. It doesn't impact their, you know, their whole life, their work, their relationships, their family. And we can really prevent a lot of suffering. So that's kind of the big picture of what this class is doing.
Now, Janet, do you see a reduction in, say, the stigma around mental health? Because I really believe that for many years, and in some cases still, there are people that are really not comfortable speaking about mental health issues publicly. Do you find that the mental health first aid protocol sort of helps people to be a little more comfortable in this arena?
Absolutely. So this class from the National Council for Mental Wellbeing people have done extensive research on what is the outcome to this class. If you attend this class, what are the things that you can expect? And so they did evidence-based research, and they said one of the things is it does reduce stigma. People are more compassionate about people with mental health issues when they take this class. The other thing is it increases their confidence and likelihood to step in and help, which is huge. They're more comfortable to connect people with resources that they know about in the area. And their own mental health is stronger after taking this class. So like it is definitely part of the stigma reducing, because so many people. And I do think it's getting better, Kay. I mean, when I see the generation coming up, they seem to be much more open to talk about their own mental health issues, which
Absolutely.
Is awesome.
Yeah.
In my generation, not so much. So I'm encouraged by seeing more people having these conversations. But you're right, it's still really difficult, especially in communities like, you know, first responder, construction workers, older adults. Those may not be where the young people are these days, but we hope to get them closer.
Absolutely. I am with you on it being definitely generational in many cases. And also there are for sure cultural areas where I'm sure you see more pushback or more stigmatization. But what great news that your organization is out there doing this. Now, you have an event coming up on September 13th at the Columbus Zoo. It's your annual Mental Health First Aid Summit. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so we're really excited about this. This is our fifth time we've done this. And it's open to people that have taken mental health first aid and want to see it expand in Ohio. And this year, first time, we have over 60 mental health first aid instructors coming. So if you're a mental health first aid instructor, you get certified by the National Council for Mental Wellbeing. You keep your certification if you teach at least three classes a year. And we have a contract with about 110 of these certified instructors that live in the state of Ohio, and they're the ones that go out and teach all our classes. So if you're part of our project, or if you're not, if you're from Ohio, if you're not from Ohio, anybody that's an instructor is welcome to come. We're going to have a track specifically for them, and they're going to learn about, you know, how to teach adults and how to get out of your own way as a presenter and how to really integrate the information to your audience so that they take away what we need them to take away with and apply it. Because if you just come to the class and you listen, that's not good enough. Like, we need to remind these mental health first aiders that you're going to make a difference in somebody's life, but you have to keep noticing, you have to keep stepping in and keep applying what you learned. So half of the group is instructors, and about the other half are people like me that are just general advocates. I might be part of another project. I might not. I might have taken mental health first aid myself, but I really see that this is a good thing for Ohio, and I want to come and help it expand.
Absolutely. Janet, for someone listening who may not have taken the mental health first aid course and just wants to know, what's a good starting place if I do recognize someone in my life that needs somebody to help? Is there a good first step or a good piece of advice to keep in mind if you're approaching a family, friend, loved one that you want to help them?
Yes, that's a great question. So the mental health first aid class teaches what's called a five-step action plan, and they call it ALGEE, A-L-G-E-E. And that plan is what you learn, and you can apply that plan if you notice beginning signs, or if you notice worsening signs, or if you show up and somebody's in a crisis. That action plan can really go through any of those three situations. And so and during the class, you learn about ALGEE, and then you practice it on scenarios. And then that's really the tools that we give you to know exactly what to do and what not to do when you approach somebody.
And where can someone go to get more information if they'd like to learn more or get involved in mental health first aid training?
Sure. Well, our collaborative website is ohiomhfa.org. But if you wanted to go to the National Council's website, you could just type in mentalhealthfirstaid.org and you'll take to the National Council for Mental Wellbeing. And that has all the research, that has evidence-based information, that has case studies, it has a ton more in general about mental health first aid. But if you wanted to take a class, or if you wanted to host a class, if you go to our website, ohiomhfa.org, you'll find all the information you need to get started there.
Mental health is as important, sometimes in some cases it can be more important than physical health. And Janet Gora, I so appreciate your time today in educating us on the mental health first aid movement and your organization. Best of luck with your upcoming summits and all the other activities that you have going on.
Thank you very much, Kate. I appreciate you asking me to be on today.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
When I turned 50, my children surprised me with an AARP membership. They thought it was hilarious. I was not amused. until I started using the service and reading the magazine. In Columbus, 28% of the population is age 50 or older. That means that over a quarter of a million seniors call the capital city home. As one of them, I can tell you firsthand, I am technically challenged and can use all the help I can get. Jim Lenahan is the technical director for AARP Magazine. He joins us now to talk tech. Jim, given everything that has happened this summer with the cybersecurity event at City Hall here in Columbus, our listeners want answers. So first, how can an individual master payment apps safely without risking a personal data breach?
Well, that's a really good question, and thanks very much for having me on. So when it comes to payment apps, the good news is they are simple to use. And so if you use something like Venmo or PayPal or Apple Pay, it's really easy to download the app to your phone, connect it to your bank account, and start making payments. Super simple. But you mentioned safety, and that is a concern. And so there's also a pretty simple solution for that, too. And what we tell people is just don't make the payment so fast, right? Because what happens is there's so many users on these apps. And say you are going to pay some money to a friend. You'll find that there are a lot of users who have similar names when you do, you know, when you do the search, that sort of thing. Just be absolutely sure. Ask your friend or be sure some other way that you have the right username and confirm that before you make the payment. Because once you make that payment, it can be really difficult, maybe even impossible, to recover the money if you send it to the wrong person.
Now, I grew up with James Bond and Get Smart, and a smartwatch was a gadget that we couldn't conceive of. What's the value of having one of those today, and how can it help us?
So what a lot of people don't realize with these smartwatches is many of them have some pretty amazing health technology built into them. So, for instance, many smartwatches can monitor your heart rate. They can also monitor your sleep. So you can get a report that tells you, you know, how deep was your sleep, how restful was your sleep, you know, how what length of time and so on and so forth. And that can be really helpful, you know, especially as we age and sleep becomes maybe more difficult. To get that kind of report, that kind of data can allow you to, you know, sort of try some different things with your sleep routine and find what's working for you.
Is diabetes one of the things that it tracks? Does it track blood sugar?
There definitely is technology for that, and a lot of times that is something special that you'll have to look into, but absolutely there's a lot more home-based personal technology that can help with all sorts of health matters.
Now, when I come home and it's dark, I like to have the ability to have my lights and my HVAC controlled, and I've recently learned that's something that I can do too, but our listeners may not know that. So what are the apps that are available to control lights and HVAC?
So the smart home technology you mentioned is something that we have written about AARP quite a bit, because there can be a lot of benefits, but also a lot of frustrations with that. So what we recommend to people is start small, find technology that is most important to you. So for instance, you mentioned, you know, if it's lights, having being able to control the lights in your home when you're away, or if it's the thermostat, whatever it may be, start small, start with one thing. Get used to that, give that a try. Once you've mastered that, then you can sort of move on to other smart home technology. And we also advise people, you don't need all of it. Just find out, just use the things that are most important and useful to you.
Seniors suffer from loneliness, and it's sometimes some people say it's a blessing, other people say it's a curse. Aside from talking to Alexa, are there apps that allow you to engage with an AI and maybe have company?
Well, there are some things like that, but what we think is more important is really understanding the best uses for social media and how different social media apps work differently. These are great ways you can stay connected with people. And, you know, one of the things we write about in this issue of the magazine is ways to connect with your children or your grandchildren through social media. You know, oftentimes they're reluctant because they don't necessarily want, you know, the older people to see what they're doing, right? So one thing we recommend is use Instagram. Instagram is a great app for connecting with people, but it also has a lot of great filtering functionality. So, you know, your kids or grandkids can, you know, share the things that they want to share with you while keeping the other stuff private. Another one that's really useful out there is called Be Real. And what's great about that app is it just asks you to send a social media photo at certain times of day. So it's kind of like a nice little check-in that you can have with different family members.
Now, it used to be that the library was the place that you would go to find senior activities in your community. But unfortunately, whether it's because of the pandemic or simply a lack of mobility, a lot of seniors are housebound. Are there apps that suggest senior activities that people can participate in? Like, for example, I like to play Scrabble. Is there a group I can play Scrabble with?
Well, you have come to the right place here because at AARP, we have tons and tons of local activities available to people. So I would suggest download our AARP app, and there you can find lots of local events that are specifically geared toward older people.
So one of the things that all seniors face is we operate on a tight budget these days. So what apps will help us find good deals? For example, we like to go out to eat, restaurants. We like to shop. Maybe we like to travel. We want to save money. How can we do that?
Yeah, a couple quick tips I'll give here. One is good news is that if there are retail stores or restaurants that you already like, if you download the app onto your phone for those specific stores or restaurants, a lot of times they have special deals for using their app. They want people to use the app. It's easier for them on their end. We don't need to get into all of that, but the good news for you is they offer special deals there. So a great way to save money. The other thing you can do is these using your computer is download what are called browser extensions. It's just a little piece of software. And what that will do is through the discount code browser extensions is it will automatically look for all those discount codes out there that you may not be aware of when you go to purchase something. It scours the internet for those codes and can apply them automatically. I just use this. I have one that I use through my credit card company and just saved, you know, $20 on some plane tickets. Not necessarily a lot of money, but hey, $20 is $20, and it's a discount I would not have known of otherwise.
So let's say I'm technophobic. Is there a group or an institution that will hold my hand while we go through all of this?
So we have lots of great resources at AARP. So go to aarp.org/tech. And there you can find lots of how-tos that really can explain how to get the best use of technology, make technology easier for you. So I mentioned how-tos. We have articles. We have videos. All sorts of resources are available. And again, we really try to focus on mainstream technology. We're not out there looking at what's the coolest cutting-edge gadget, but really what are people using today and how can they use it better?
Jim Lenihan is the technical editor for AARP Magazine. We thank you for your insight and your time today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Thanks very much.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
Election Day, November 5th, is now just a little more than 2 months away. Early voting starts on October 8th. Ohio has one of the most closely watched races in the country, the race for U.S. Senate between incumbent Democrat Sherrod Brown and his opponent, Republican Bernie Moreno. We want to focus on the issues in this race. I've been in contact with Bernie Moreno's campaign about having him on this program, as he was before the primary, to discuss his stances on the key issues. I'm waiting to hear back. Now, I did sit down with Senator Brown as he runs for a fourth term in the U.S. Senate. We talked about the economy, abortion, the southern border, and the conflicts between Ukraine and Russia and Israel and Hamas. I started by asking him what he sees as the most important issue that needs to be addressed to help Ohioans.
Politics is really whose side you're on. It's not sort of a left to right spectrum, liberal, conservative. It's who you're fighting for. And too often the federal government and state government have stood on the side of special interest. And my job is to stand up, whether it's to the drug companies, to the railroads in East Palestine, to Wall Street, because when you see, you know, the wealthy are getting wealthier in this country and the middle class shrinking and people that get up and work every day and work hard every day don't have enough to show for it. It's because of special interest politics and government. And my job will always be to stand up for Ohioans. And I look at the job as not as Democrat or Republican, not as Trump or Biden or now Harris or Obama. I look at it as who's doing the right things for Ohio. And that's why I have disagreed with presidents of both parties on trade, or why I've stood up to presidents of both parties on the border. That we've got to do better, and that means looking out first and foremost for Ohio voters.
As chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, what should be done to help, you know, lower those costs of living right now that people are, we're seeing the high costs of, you know, things like groceries and housing?
One of the things we've been able to do is, and this took far too many years, is to put a cap on insulin prices. Now that I met a guy yesterday who still pays $200 for insulin. He's not Medicare eligible yet. And he about $200 a month, and we have been able to cap insulin prices for Medicare beneficiaries at $35 a month. That's a big part. That's a huge cost for an increasing number of people in this country. And I want to extend that in my next term to everybody, not just people
in
Medicare.
To make it universal.
And the drug companies rarely lose, just like Norfolk Southern rarely loses on this fight in East Palestine, just like Wall Street rarely loses. And I think the contrast between my opponent and me is he always is on the side of those special interests. I stand up to him, and we've had victories on fixing pensions for 100,000 workers in this state. 100,000 workers were going to lose half their pensions. We fixed that. What we're able to named after Ohio, we were able to fix the veterans, soldiers, and Marines who are exposed to those football field-sized burn pits. We're able to make sure they get health care. That bill's named after Ohio and Central Ohio from Pickerington, Heath Robinson. So it's really standing up for Ohioans against these special interests.
What should the Fed do about inflation?
Well, the Fed should bring interest rates down, clearly. I've asked the chair. I know the chair. He's, the banking committee that I chair oversees the Federal Reserve. We've pushed him in hearings. I've talked to him privately the importance of moving faster and bringing interest rates down. People are paying too much. It's hurt small business. People are paying too much for home mortgages. Just a gentleman I was just talking to in my staff bought his house just before these interest rates went up. He was lucky, but they went up for so many people, and it's made the housing, it's made it more difficult for particularly young people, but anybody to be able to get into the housing market. And we know that to buy that first house mm-hmm. can help to set you for life, and that you then have some amount of wealth that you can build and ultimately pass on to your kids.
Well, speaking of that, Vice President Harris recently came out in support of a $25,000 federal assistance for down payments for for first-time home buyers. I guess President Biden's proposal was $10,000. Where do you stand on that?
I appreciate that she's interested in it, that she focuses already on the dignity of work and on housing. I would hope that any president would do that. I've endorsed Vice President Harris. But I think that what we're trying to do, and I can talk more practically, is we're working on legislation that provides to help, now doesn't give a subsidy, it helps them advance on the down payment. So right now in this country, many veterans can buy a house in many cases, the down payment that says they can't get in the market, but it rolls the down payment into later payments. So a lot of veterans are in homes now because of that. I have a bill to extend that to police, fire, and teachers. I would like to widen that so that to create the opportunity of more people buying home, getting to be able to buy homes. And I'm concerned about a subsidy. Just does that mean house prices go up? I want to help with that down payment and figure out the best way to do this.
Because you worry that actually could
Yeah, people say that. I don't know. I should answer the question at the beginning this way. I want to try to look at every option. Housing is too expensive. Too many people can't get homes. Too many young people think they're never going to be able to buy a home because of government policies, presidents of both parties for the last couple of decades. So, I look at what we did in this country with the GI Bill and what we've done a number of times to get people able to get an education, get people able to buy a home. And when I say education, I don't mean just four-year colleges. I also mean Columbus State, or I also mean trade school.
Where do you stand on student loan forgiveness?
Yeah, I want to help. First of all, the most important thing is to bring college costs down. And I see what's happened on a number of schools. Bluffton College is now merging with the University of Findlay, not in this jurisdiction, not in this media market, but up in Northwest Ohio. We're seeing too many colleges struggle financially. We're seeing too many kids struggle financially. I would like to see those debt wiped away. I think we need to do that in as many cases as we can. But I think you also look at the other end, why college is too expensive, and giving people a path. Too much emphasis in this society of you got to go to college, you got to go to college, you got to go to college. And for many people, it was that way for me. I assume because you're sitting there like this, it was that way for you. But it's not the best thing, nor does every kid. You know, half the adults in this state didn't go to college or don't have college degrees. And sometimes that's choice, sometimes it's cost. We need to deal with the cost, but we need to give people opportunity, like building futures, giving those kids a chance to make a decent living. I mean, to me, when I talk about the dignity of work, it always means that you should be, whether you swipe a badge or punch a clock or work for tips or work in an office or work on a salary, you ought to be rewarded. Your hard work should be rewarded, that you get a chance to get ahead. Too many cases in this country, it isn't.
You've been known to be hard on international trade. Do you believe America should do more when it comes to tariffs? We've heard former President Trump talk about increasing tariffs on Chinese goods.
I don't think it's an across-the-board approach that's the best thing. And I've stood up to presidents of my own party on trade issues forever, and I think presidents of both parties have failed the American public. I spent early in my career fighting Bill Clinton on NAFTA. I think it was a terrible thing for our state. And I fought George Bush on the next round, something called the Central American Free Trade Agreement, because they both were wrong. I think that, we finally in this country now have what I've been advocating for, an industrial policy where we find ways to bring American manufacturing back to this country. It will only work if we enforce trade agreements. And I've had some differences with the Biden administration asking them to strengthen some of the enforcement on solar panels, on steel. We are bringing back, because we've done it right now, 600 jobs. It's Weirton, West Virginia. A lot of Ohioans in eastern Ohio will benefit from this. We have the largest solar manufacturer in North America, First Solar. I've worked with them. They're up near Toledo. I've worked with them to make sure that China can't, because they pay very low wages and ignore environmental laws, that China can't undercut their solar panels, because China can almost always produce something more cheaply because they don't pay their workers much, and sometimes slave labor, child labor, and because they don't follow worker safety and environmental laws. We should never compromise on our worker safety laws. Our environmental laws are here for a reason and have made our quality of life better, and I want to keep those strong.
Ohio has attracted some big companies, obviously with Intel and Licking County, Google, Amazon. What should be done to continue this trend of Ohio being attractive to larger businesses to continue economic growth in Central Ohio?
Well, what we should have, we should be a state that's welcoming. Part of this is what economic incentives you put together, but we were talking, I guess I can disclose what we were talking about when we were walking in, that you like this city because you like the quality of life here. And the quality of life in Columbus I don't think there's any place better than the quality of life in Ohio. I worry, though, about what this state's doing on undermining public education. I worry about what this state was doing on a number of other issues that make it a little less attractive. I'll leave it at that. But I think that we're doing some of the right things here. But I want to see our kids. We still have far too many kids leaving, young people leaving. I ask people all the time that are 50 and up, are your kids still here? And too many of them say no, and I think that we've got to do a lot better on that if we're going to attract these bigger companies.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
Now back to my interview with Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown as he seeks a fourth term in the U.S. Senate. We turn to foreign policy. First, whether the U.S. should continue sending military aid indefinitely to help Ukraine defend itself from the Russian invasion.
Think about how this plays out. If Putin overruns, if they overrun Ukraine, then they're right up to NATO's border. And our commitment to NATO through NATO is if a NATO country is attacked, we send troops. That's our commitment. It's been our commitment for 80 years, 75, 1946, whatever, how many years. It's our commitment, and we live by it. That's why we're not sending soldiers to Ukraine. We're sending dollars. We're sending weapons, not dollars. In the weapons, some of those weapons are made in Lima, Ohio. So these are a lot of American jobs.
The tanks, right?
Yeah, the tanks. Yeah. I don't make the decision based on American jobs, but I do make the decision based on our ally, Ukraine, and keeping Russia from overrunning Ukraine and being up against the border.
Your opponent blames the Biden-Harris administration and you, basically, for the situation at the southern border, criminals being allowed in to commit more crimes here, according to some of their ads. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, I'm not going to answer every negative ad, but I again make the contrast. I voted for the strongest border bill, bipartisan border bill endorsed by the Border Patrol Union, and they're not a union that supports Democrats very often. They support this bill. My opponent opposed it. We should move decisively quickly in that. And the other part of that is fentanyl. And I wrote with a Republican ranking member, it's called the senior Republican on my committee that I chair, the Fend Off Fentanyl Bill, to go after the money. It goes after the precursor chemical makers in China, in communist China. It goes after the cartels in Mexico that make this stuff. We got to keep this stuff out. You go after the money, you make this a whole lot less profitable. You go after their bank accounts, you freeze their assets, you use the tools of our federal government to keep this stuff out of the country. You got to do more, too. You got to support the police and having detection equipment. You've got to have more detection equipment at the border. You've got to make sure our police have Narcan, that our police have the protective equipment handling this stuff. It's a really all the above approach. But my bill, the most important is keeping this stuff out. My bill passed. It's now law. Mm-hmm. Federal agents are working on this.
Does the bipartisan border security bill have any chance of passing, no matter who wins the presidential race?
I think it has a great chance to passage. Kamala Harris at the convention said if she's elected, she's going to immediately work on that. I think Trump probably would work on it, too. He's opposed to it now because he basically said, kill the bill. I want to use this as a political issue. I think Trump's still for the bill. So next year, I think regardless of the winner, we have a real chance.
Where do you stand on, you know, the numbers of people that are coming across the border and what should be done with them if they don't have the documentation in here through the system?
Yeah, if people have proper documentation, you keep them here. You help them. You know, they're working. If they have the proper documentation, they're working. We've always been that country. That's the most important thing to do. If someone commits a crime and is here, if someone commits a crime, period, whether they're an immigrant or one of us, the government should take action, the local courts. And if they're here illegally, they commit a crime, they should be deported, clearly.
What if they're here illegally, period?
Well, we've got to work that through. And this bill that this strongest border bill we've ever had in front of us, again, supported by the Border Patrol, would help to take care of that. But we need to be serious. And my opponent's playing politics with it, of course. I mean, that's the ads he runs. That's the ads all over the country. They think there's political benefit there. But I think voters want a solution. And those ads aren't a solution. A solution is the bill we've tried to pass. And, you know, and it's on everything. I mean, there's this contrast. I mean, my opponent is for a national abortion ban, even though Ohioans, 57% voted that they wanted reproductive rights in the Constitution here. So all of these contrasts on every issue are pretty clear.
Do you expect or do you believe that there is still momentum for a national ban on abortion despite former President Trump basically saying, hey, it's now a state's issue since Roe v. Wade was overturned? And, you know, I think abortion was mentioned one time in the Republican platform. Going into the RNC, are you concerned that there is still momentum to have something like that push through?
Oh, I think, Omar, I think Ohioans don't trust when they hear a politician say, oh, we're going to take care of this when, you know, this state had basically an entire essentially an abortion ban period. And I think most people in Ohio know that if they can get away with that, they'll do it again because they're listening to their special interest friend. That's what's important about our constitutional amendment in Ohio. That's what's important when you go to vote this year. Look at who's on your side on abortion. And I think women particularly, but I think generally people in Ohio don't want government making this decision. They want their doctor, the woman and her family, if she chooses, and the doctor to make this decision, not politicians. And it's clear from all the dancing and moving and you know, all the things that my opponent's doing and others, that they're still playing games with abortion. They're trying to find out, what do I say that gets me past this? But the fact is, I think most people don't trust them on this issue because they believe that they want, my opponent wants the government to make these decisions.
Senator Brown's opponent, Bernie Moreno, has told me he supports a ban on abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy with common sense restrictions after that time period. But he also said now that the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, it is predominantly a state issue.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS-FM 97.1 The Fan and 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.